This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 6th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 322 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Mr. Stephen Bloomfield.
On today's show, we'll be hearing about the life of US intellectual satirist and writer of novels, essays, films and stage plays, Gore Vidal. And the person telling his story was part of it himself. Writer and academic Jay Perini will be here a little later.
Then we'll be hearing from a Hollywood player who takes inspirations from cinema's more dark, seedy and kitsch underbelly, Nicholas Winding Refn, the author behind box office hits such as Drive and Bronson, will be explaining his love of exploitation cinema along with fellow film buff Alan Jones.
And in a week when migration and border crossings have dominated the headlines, we'll be hearing from comedian Mark Cooper-Jones about why his favourite subject, geography, is now a burning hot news issue.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli will be pulling up curbside in the current affairs Cadillac with some of the next week's biggest stories, possibly, and we'll also fit in some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, Andrew, that was a good week, wasn't it?
That was a good week. Should we do the ticks? New baby. Not you and me,
but
new baby for Mr. Tom Edwards.
Oh, right, yes. I know the name as well.
I think it's been publicly released, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is?
Fred. Fred Woods.
Frederick. Is it Fred or Frederick?
Alfred.
Alfred.
But Fred Woods is essentially how he's going to be known.
Okay, that's tick. Well done, all in the Edwards household. We launched the Monocle Minute.
Yes, so another little baby.
Took more than a minute to launch. This is a new email service. Please go to monocle.com. Sign up now. We need your names. And we'll send you a nice little kind of news roundup every morning. And it's fun too.
It is fun too.
It's got a bit of radio on it as well. Yeah, it's got a little bit of radio link. On Monday, we launched the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes.
Yes.
Bang.
Out. Easy. Done.
What a good week, hey? That's called a media week.
And also, we have been in Berlin this week.
It's called a baby media sandwich. That's a bit wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah, we were in Berlin, missing our friends at Gestalten. We went there to see them on Thursday.
Thursday. And, we can't really say. Can we say much about what we're talking about?
Well, you're meant to be doing a book and you're behind.
I'm not behind.
It's all good.
I'm just thinking.
It's going to be very short.
So it'll be very good. And next week, Andrew, you're going to be away. You're on tour.
Yeah. So if you're a subscriber in, I'm hoping we've sent you all the invitations. We're going to be popping through Vienna, Munich, Frankfurt and Milan to launch the Cozy Homes book. And we'll be doing events in each of those cities on nights next week. And then watch out because we'll be going to Reykjavik, New York, Portland, Amsterdam, all sorts of places.
Are these launches all going to be in Cozy Homes?
No, but they're in cozy design stores.
Okay.
There's a connection.
Good. Lovely. Okay, well, that all sounds rather smashing. And as does the show we've got lined up today. However, before we get to the really, really good stuff, there is one thing we have to sort of do contractually.
Let's pull in Mr. Danny Giacopelli.
Danny, there's no other but Danny.
She's the only one who loves Danny every bit more each day.
We should say that you've kind of been in Tom Edwards' chair.
Yeah.
You've sat in your own chair.
I haven't moved into his physical space yet.
You've been running little old Monocle 24 the last week, and you don't seem to have got grey hair yet.
The bloodless coup continues. But his beard has got bigger.
Yeah. His beard and his hair, and he's gone for a quilted jacket as well.
Have you basically decided you're not going to shave until Tom gets back?
Yeah, essentially. It's a protest beard. That's what it is.
It's like a dirty protest.
Yeah. Now, do you want to take us through what's going to happen over the following week?
By the way, I've had comments about my beard from listeners who have heard you guys speak about my beard. So I think my beard's getting a bit famous.
Yeah, and...
infamous.
We'll move on. So let's, again, serious stuff to fun stuff. Very serious stuff today. In Berlin, there's a summit to discuss migrants Well, the German coalition government is holding this. So basically, what can Germany do about the migrant situation?
Well, it has 800,000 people currently who have arrived this year alone in Germany. So an extraordinary story for the country.
And what's been interesting is how Angela Merkel's image just a month or so ago when we were talking about Greece, Germany's image was very much sort of less positive, I think it's fair to say, throughout Europe. And yet she's really shown, I think a number of people say, quite a bit of leadership in the last couple of weeks on this issue, in at least trying to do something.
They're trying to do something, although it's still quite hard to fathom exactly what she wants the end game to be, because she's certainly putting pressure on everybody else to take some of these 800,000 people. So it's not like she's saying, okay, you know, all of you are going to stay in Germany. First of all, there's a huge number of people who are economic migrants, and she's made clear will not get any kind of sanctuary in Germany. And then of the remainder, she's still in hopes that many of them will move on to other wealthy northern European countries. But, you know, she needs to get a real conversation going fast. And that's why she's hinted that, you know, there may be border controls, all sorts of things in a bid to finally kind of bring the situation under control.
Yeah. And everything I've read is the summit held today is discussing plans to create tens of thousands of refugee centers around the country. So that's what they'll be discussing. Let's move to Singapore now. On the 11th, there'll be an early general election that's been called. And a lot of people are saying it's been called because it's been the 50th anniversary of the city-state right now, and people are feeling good, essentially. So now's the time to hold it.
Why not hold an election when people are feeling good? It's interesting as well, as you say, it is, you know, it's a big, anyone who's been to Singapore this year can't fail to have noticed their huge celebrations for the fact that the country's turning 50. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see whether that's sort of goodwill towards the government that has been obviously been built up throughout this year is reflected in the polls.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, amazing paternalistic country. I don't think maybe people think there's going to be any kind of revolution there anytime soon.
No, I don't think so. But we'll be following this all week with Nolan Giles, our bureau chief there. Also next week, you guys have iPhones or Blackberries? I don't know what you have, but it's the iPhone 6S will be revealed. And we'll be actually covering that. David Phelan will be there covering that for us. Also next week, London International Shipping Week. I've actually been to that.
Have you?
A couple of years ago. It is really, I don't want to use the word fun, but it's
hold on, you were excited about going on the world's biggest ship, weren't you?
Well, that was something different. I did go on the world's biggest.
He's done a lot of shipping stuff.
Yeah, the Maersk Triple E, which 3 years ago was the world's biggest ship, but it gets displaced, no pun intended, every year by another bigger ship. So at the time, it was the biggest ship, and I did go in Copenhagen on it with their crew. It was a lot of fun.
But the shipping congress?
This is just like a wonky kind of thing. So, you know, everybody from ship suppliers, commodity traders, brokers, you know, a lot of insurance people, they all meet. And in fact, it was on a boat in the Thames. I went to this one event. It's kind of fun if you like that kind of stuff.
And you get to see some ships?
You get to see some ships.
They talk ship. Okay.
Yeah. And some shipping insurance people.
Yeah, it's actually more interesting than it sounds, shipping insurance, but I won't get into it now. Labor Day is on the 7th in the US.
I know. I do know.
Our bureau is probably going to be closed. Is that why you know?
Or? No, I know because it's. I was looking at it because it's quite a big retail weekend.
Mm,
so
indeed.
You can gauge how well America is doing by what people spend that weekend.
I feel like this is something that might have appeared or might be about to appear in the Monocle Minute.
Well, there you go.
Guessing,
the Monocle Minute is changing changing the dynamic of my day. I know more things than I ever thought I would want to know.
Well,
after
speaking
doing
of retail, the World Retail Congress is taking place in Rome on the 8th. Did
and
you
what
know,
happened?
Did
what
you
was
know
at the
that?
World's Retail Conference? Look at Andrew's taking notes.
I am taking notes.
He's like, oh, we should write about that.
That is prime Monocle Minute. He's actually writing it down.
He is right now.
Well, because I'm writing it down because I thought you could write it out.
World Retail Congress.
You haven't given me an idea all week, so I've got one for you now.
The 8th to the 10th, it's being held in Rome.
What's going on there?
Retail-ish kind of things.
Write 100 words for us.
Send me to Rome.
Okay, you're just reading out a diary now.
No,
give us something you know something about.
Here's something that's fun. It's a bit parochial, but next week, Queen Elizabeth, longest reigning monarch in the UK, actually in Europe.
Longest reigning monarch. We've only got one of them in the UK, so of course she's the longest reigning monarch in the UK.
Oh, so she becomes the longest reigning in Europe?
Yeah. Ever.
Really?
Indeed.
Wasn't she that already?
No.
The longest reigning monarch in British history on the 9th.
Oh, she beats Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
Well, there
that's,
we are.
That's something, right?
Yeah, that's something.
Good genes. You know,
really?
Well, yeah. Queen Mother.
I don't think that's the case with royalty, is it?
Oh, no. Queen Mother, her mum, 101.
Yeah.
Elizabeth has got a long way to go, yeah.
How did
Charles, who's like, well, we don't want to get into this debate.
Don't do family trees now.
What? I'm just saying. You know.
That's all I got. It's a packed week. Nice selection. Nothing too zany. No mud wrestling or potato wrestling or
mud,
you know,
is mud rustling like
tomato
mud
throwing.
But that's just in your downtime.
Also,
Danny.
I'll be in Sicily next week, so you won't.
Oh my god! Back with the family.
In fact, you joke, but my ancestors are from there. But
I don't joke. It's just that you're the only person with such an Italian name who doesn't speak a word of it.
I speak some Italian.
Can barely get his quattro formaggi when he needs it. But Danny Giacopelli, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your cultural heritage.
Essayist, author, film dramatist and intellectual, Gore Vidal was a 20th century icon of both popular and high-minded culture until his death in 2012, aged 86. His 200 essays and 24 novels delved into topics at the very heart of what it means to be American, ranging from politics to sexuality. And his opinionated wit earned him both many fans and a few enemies along the way. His feuds with fellow giants of the era such as Truman Capote and Norman Mailer were famous and wholly appropriate for a man who would effortlessly reel off quotes such as, "Style is knowing who you are, what you want to say, and not giving a damn."
He's now the subject of a new book, and its title is taken from another of those great quotes: "Every time a friend succeeds, something inside me dies." The life of Gore Vidal, and it's written by fellow author and academic Jay Perini, who was a friend of Vidal during his later years, and he joins us now to talk about it. Tell us first of all about that friendship, because that is really what gives you a unique perspective on Vidal.
Well, it's a bit of a strange story. About 30 years ago, my wife and I took a year in southern Italy. And we rented this villa on a cliff overlooking a sea in Atrani, right by Amalfi and Ravello. And there was this lemon grove behind our terrace and this mammoth 20-some million palazzo sitting on the hilltop, La Rondinaia. And I said to the tobacconist, "Who lives up there?" He said, "Oh, Gore Vidal." I said, "Does he ever come down here and mix with the hoi polloi?" He said, "Well, yeah, every day he walks past your house, buys a newspaper for me and gets a drink in the Bar Serena next door." So I left a note: "Dear Mr. Vidal, I'm an American writer and teacher at a university, and I'll be here for the year. And I'd love to meet you if there's a chance." The next day, boom, boom, boom. "Perini," he said, "come for dinner." So I went up to the great villa. I was terrified. You know, I met his boyfriend of 50 years, Howard, well then 20 years. And I said to Howard, "Howard," I said, "what do you do?" He said, "I'm Gore's secretary." I said, "Well, what does that entail, being Gore's secretary?" He said, "Put it this way, big boy, I don't type." So every day, 4 o'clock, he would boom, 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 my wife's eyes would roll, and Gore would say, "Perini, let's have a drink." And sometimes we drank till, I have to confess, till 4 in the morning. And I saw him every day for that year, and a very intimate friendship developed, and I became obsessed with him. I mean, he was a very bright flame, and I was a moth drawn to it. I was a young writer. I just published my first novel. My first book of poems had come out from Random House. I was writing for the New York Times, the TLS, and Gore said, "Oh my God, here's a guy who has a lot in common with me." And we talked about movies, about books. We both loved Henry James, Mark Twain, Henry Adams. We knew some of the same people in London. I'd lived in Britain for a lot. Stephen Spender was a mutual friend. So we had lots to talk about. And so I went back to the villa in Italy. We rented it in the summers, and Gore and I started talking on the phone otherwise. Sometimes we talked every day, sometimes every week. And we would travel together, and to the end of his life, we were very close. And it was difficult. He was a pain in the ass. He was so difficult. And I often wondered, in 1986, he asked me if I'd write his biography, and I said, "When you're dead." And so he agreed to that arrangement and introduced me. So for 25 years, I was gathering material. He sent me over to Antibes to talk to Graham Greene and to Anthony Burgess. Went to talk to Frederick Prokosh. He took me to dinner with people like Alberto Moravia. We had to have dinner many times with his friends, you know, Paul Newman. Yeah, I met the great and the good through Gore. It was always quite a scenario. In my book, there are 13 little vignettes. The time my wife and I went on a a boating trip on Gore's yacht up the coast of Italy with Leonard Bernstein. And, you know, talk about two gigantic egos. And, you know, being on a boat with these guys, it was a headache.
Did you find it difficult during those 30 years having an equal relationship with Vidal? Because, as you say, you were the moth drawn to his flame. From early on in that relationship, you'd made this agreement that you were going to be writing his biography. Did you feel that it was a friendship of equals?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. In my heart of hearts, I felt I was equal to Gore, in some ways a better writer. That sounds very arrogant to say that, but I felt it was true, and maybe that allowed me to keep the relationship going. You know, I'll never forget when my novel about Tolstoy, The Last Station, made into a film, was reviewed on the front page of the TLS by John Bailey, and he said it's a masterpiece, and he said, I know Perini mentions that his mentor is Gore Vidal, but he's a better writer than Gore Vidal. Gore was furious. And so I always felt, look, I've got my own career. I don't have Gore's fame. And I frankly didn't give a damn. And so I was quite happy to watch this thing happening. Gore Vidal in front of me. Watch him put on this mask, Gore Vidal, go out on stage, be a kind of Oscar Wilde figure, then come back to me, take the mask off, have a drink. And he was a very insecure guy.
I wanted to ask you about that mask and that presentation, because the two, it's interesting, now when we look back, you know, we've done it here, we've quoted these bon mots, these kind of clever, witty phrases from him, but in a way that reduces him too much, doesn't it? Because, you know, he did have these sharp moments, you know, these famous falling out with people, but he was a kind of a great essayist. He had a perspective on liberal America, on politics, on the changing culture, that perhaps when you go back to, you realise, you know, he was good, he was sharp.
Oh, come on. He was incredibly intelligent. If anybody wants to see, and I did a TV interview with Gore and Noam Chomsky in 1991. It's an hour-long video. And if you just go to my website, jperini.com, boom, it comes right up. You can watch the whole thing, the old tape, a grainy tape of it. And you realize that Gore had an incredibly sinuous intelligence. He had a vast store of knowledge. He could frame an argument. And, you know, I basically agreed with him that America had turned into an empire. You know, when the Iraq War came along, I was thrilled to see Gore's opposition to the war. And then, you know, his fight with Christopher Hitchens was all about that. So it was a very interesting scene to watch Gore's life unfold.
Do you feel that there was this golden age of American essayists and intellectuals who would, you know, would argue, would have different views? There would perhaps obviously be feuds as well, but there were big issues being discussed by big people that perhaps is lacking today? Or is that just, you know, looking back with slightly rose-tinted glasses?
You know, I remember Gore on TV in 68 debating William F. Buckley during the Vietnam War. Those conversations between Mailer and Vidal, Mailer and Buckley, those were huge conversations by serious people who had a great deal of knowledge. Nowadays, you don't see as much of it. And so I think the level of discourse has, to some degree, dropped, and we don't have as many figures with the same kind of knowledge, the same kind of wit. So I do think that there is a decline in the culture.
Tell me about his, you know, you talked about his private life at the beginning there, and, you know, that was a theme that ran through. This was in a time when it was very uncomfortable to be out in public as gay or as homosexual, and there were people who were taking snipes at him throughout that time. How much was his sexuality part of who his public persona was?
Gore was tremendously sexual. He had a big, big sex drive. And starting from the age of 19 or 20, he was picking up guys in the streets in Guatemala and New York City, mainly in Rome, where he would, you know, go for street boys, then finally in Bangkok. So sex was a big part of Gore's life, but it was a private part of his life. He was open about it. When he was interviewed by Dan Rather on 60 Minutes on CBS in 1975, he said, look, I have a lot of sex. I have sex with men, and it's good for my health. I enjoy it. And he said, but that's just a little part of who I am. But I think, you know, Gore's tremendous drive as a writer, 25 novels, hundreds and hundreds of essays, 100 screenplays, Broadway hits. A lot of that drive is somehow intimately connected with the same drive that was toward sexuality. Gore always called himself bisexual, and he never said he was gay. He'd always say, I'm bisexual. I quote in the book, Howard, his boyfriend, was a close friend of mine, and I said, Howard is Gore really a bisexual? You've lived with him for 50 years. And he said, if Gore is bisexual, I'm Genghis Khan.
You mentioned just there his plays on Broadway as well. And when you, as we said in the introduction, you know, he did everything pretty much.
Everything.
Do you think he did everything as well? Or was there sort of one thing you think, actually, you know what? He was a great novelist, but his essays were almost as good. Or is he more than a sum of his parts?
Look, I've been reading Gore for 30 years very, very carefully. I've read everything many times. He wrote three great novels, and they're not, well, I wouldn't say they're up there with, Charles Dickens or Jane Austen, but there are three very good novels. Burr, Lincoln, two American novels about great American figures in politics, and Julian, about Julian the Apostate, the great Roman emperor. Those are his three great works. Myra Breckinridge was a 1968 novel. It's kind of a witty romp, but I don't think it can be really taken seriously as a work of fiction, except for, you know, some of its social, it has lots of social implications. He was a great essayist. I don't know if you've seen his collected works. It's a 1,300-page book called United States, and it's, 50 years of great essays. Gore was a wonderful critic, a wonderful memoirist, and social critic and political critic. That's where the energy lies in his work. But, as John Lahr once said, Gore pisses from an enormous height. So he was a terrible, terrible snob, and that's the hard part of him. But I really think, get his collected essays. It's massive. It's one of those books that should have been published with little wheels and a retractable handle. But it's wonderful writing.
Tell me, we've made it clear that you were friends, but as you talk about him, you talk about him in a very rich and honest way, and that's certainly how people have judged this book. This is a book which, in the end, it's a book about somebody who appreciates what Gore Vidal did, but wants to tell the truth as well. Is that a very difficult thing to do when you've known the man so well? When you say you've spent so many nights carousing and talking about the world, to come away and say, actually, I am going to tell the story with the dents as well.
We talked about this 3 or 4 years before he died. I was sitting at 2 a.m, he'd just finished an entire bottle of scotch. And he said, so are you going to write this book? And I said, I am, Gore. In fact, I've been writing it for 25 years, bits and pieces. And he said, well, I want you to point out the potholes in the road, do that. But don't lose the main journey, where you're headed. And so I realized when I started to really put this together that if I wrote a whitewash and said, oh, he was the sweetest man, everybody knows that Gore was a pain in the ass. Everybody knows that he was prejudiced and awful in some ways, that he was a terrible drunk. But people like me who knew him know that he was actually a very sweet man as well. And I wanted to tell the story as I saw it. You only live once. This is one of the stories that happened to come to me on a silver platter, or perhaps a silver-plated platter. And I wanted to tell it honestly, and it's an incredible tale. And readers so far have said, I really told the story.
Can I just ask you one thing? At the end of the book, there's a hint of disappointment on your part with him, though, when he dies and there's, the whole estate is handed over to Harvard, and you kind of look around at the people who knew him and what he could have done, and you wonder why he did that. When that happened at the very end, when the will was published, were you a little dismayed at his behavior, even in death?
Yeah, even in death, Gore caused trouble. I had tried to talk him for some years into creating a Gore Vidal Foundation. I thought that I had him one day when I said, Norman Mailer has created a Norman Mailer Foundation. And he said, Norman Mailer is such an asshole. So that didn't work out. So I wished he had. Can I just end with the Norman Mailer story?
Oh, yes. Let's end there.
And there. I remember I had often had dinner with Gore and Norman Mailer, and that was always fun to watch them. And they were fighting one day. And afterward, there was a party at this woman's apartment in New York. The great and the good were all surrounding Gore, and Gore was, dropping his bon mot. In walks Mailer, furious. And he comes up to Gore, says nothing, and suddenly takes a swift uppercut and catches Gore right in the bottom lip. Everybody's aghast. Gore steps back. Gore's a big man. Mailer's a little short guy. Gore takes out his handkerchief, a white one, daubs his lip, blood on the handkerchief. And Gore says, Norman, once again, words have failed you.
I had one more question, but I'm not going to.
I think we should leave it there. Jay Perini, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for being on the Monocle Weekly.
Very fun to be here. Thanks.
Time for some music now here on The Weekly. This is some louche disco-tinged pop from Atlanta's Deer Hunter with Snakeskin.
Now that was mighty good, wasn't it? That was Deer Hunter from Atlanta with Snakeskin. And you're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're going to be talking to Nicholas Winding Refn right after this.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
Nicholas Winding Refn is the Danish cinematic mind behind Hollywood hits such as Drive, starring Ryan Gosling, and more niche yet no less distinct work such as the Pusher series, which explores the criminal underworld of Copenhagen, and Bronson, which looked at the life of one of the UK's most notorious prisoners.
But Refn's cinematic eye is just as coveted for his ability to capture a stylishly iconic shot as it is a visceral gutter punch of a story. And it's that ability to shine and shock in equal measure. There's a theme of a new book from the director. The Act of Seeing, written in collaboration with British horror cinema expert Alan Jones, co-curator of London's Fright Fest Festival, showcases the director's collection of classic film posters from the era of exploitation cinema. So that's horror, erotica, trash, and seedier side of film history. Monocle's Tom Hall went to meet both Nicholas and Alan a little earlier.
Nicholas, I wanted to start first with you. Exploitation film, I mean, the very name of it, it's about exploiting these sort of very almost base human emotions, fear, sex, scandal. How did you come across this vast collection of just pure unusual things?
Well, I collect a filmmaker called Andy Milligan, and a friend of mine, a writer in the US called Jimmy McDernough, had written a biography of Andy Milligan, but also owned all the Milligan estate that I bought from Jimmy for my own collection. And we became friends. And after a certain amount of time, he said, look, I'm cleaning up my basement of all these posters. Do you want them? I was a bit hesitant, but then he said, it's the mother load. And I said, yeah, sure, why not? But I didn't know it was going to be 1,000 posters. And when they arrived, it was a bit like, okay, what do I do with this? But seeing that I didn't know any of the movies, basically, I thought they would make a very interesting coffee table book.
And that's an interesting point, that you haven't seen a lot of the films, because obviously the visual language in the posters is so strong. Alan, tell us, you added the words. I mean, is your knowledge of these films a reaction to the poster work, or is it, have you seen a lot of them and you're, I mean, because you're a huge fan of this genre anyway?
I'd seen about 45% of the films that, you know, the posters and Nicholas chose. So it was really, to be honest with you, the book changed so much as it was going through the years that we did it. So it's actually become, I think, more obscure as it's gone on. But I thought that was a really important thing, because so much of the films that are actually documented here, there's nothing on. It was an enormous research job for me. There were some films I couldn't find anything on until I really, really dug so deep you wouldn't believe. So I'd seen about 45% of them. But I didn't want to just write stuff about things I'd already seen before. And it was very important to Nicholas that they weren't reviews. It wasn't me saying, well, this is a terrible film and that's not very good. It was important that we just put down the facts, state them cleanly, you know, okay, with a bit of style, and there's all that going on. But we didn't want to sort of like be unfair to them, especially as we hadn't seen quite a lot of them. I'm sure they're terrible. I'm sure, you know, like 99% of them are absolute junk. But you never know. I mean, Nicholas is a particular fan of the work of Joe Sarno and Doris Wishman, so there's some in there. But I mean, you know, that's why we wanted to do it. We just wanted to make sure that it was a permanent record of these, in a way, because seriously, there are so many films in there that no one has ever heard of.
But there are little nuggets in there. Like if you read the piece about a film called Night Tide, I see that it starred Dennis Hopper, and Dennis Hopper was sort of really annoyed about, I think, having to do like TV work. And I guess he sort of took a chance to star in any kind of film he could, almost. I mean, it almost doesn't matter that, as you say, some of these films might be absolutely terrible. It's kind of interesting they are an essential chapter of cinema history, aren't they?
Night Tide is actually one of Nicholas's favourite, that we have two of those there. Curtis Harrington, the director of that, was, you know, Nicholas admires very, very much. And it was an interesting story behind those films, wasn't it? Because one poster promoted the film one way, the other poster promoted it to an entirely different audience. That's how they did it back then. You know, you weren't just sort of like one demographic. They took it all around the States, and especially because these are all one-sheet posters. And they actually sort of like drew the poster to appeal to the local population. So it's actually quite interesting. So yeah, so that there's all that history going on as well. And I mean, you know, just the taglines making you want to come and see it. I mean, usually the more outrageous the taglines, you know, you will never see anything as shocking as this in the whole history of the universe, the worse the film. But I mean, it was a case of it needs to be saying, I mean, other books have done this before. They haven't done it quite so well in quite the way that Nicholas wanted to do it, because he's actually edited it like one of his own films. So essentially what you do when you buy the book, you actually are getting the new work by Nicholas Winding Refn.
Nicholas, tell me a little bit about Night Tide then. What is it that appeals about that particular film to you?
Well, I was very fortunate to be friends with Curtis Harrington before he passed away, and he had a very sad career in a way that he made great films, but he felt very unrecognized and in the end couldn't get work, which unfortunately happens to a lot of filmmakers. For me, I just love the movie Night Tide. I think it's an absolute marvelous fairy tale, and I find it very inspiring, and it's a film I've been thinking a lot about ever since I've seen it many years ago. And that's why I also wanted to include both posters in the book, because of my admiration for Curtis and his importance for interesting cinema. You know, there's different kinds of cinema, and there's trash, or there's good and bad and high art and low art. But you know, more than anything else, what's interesting is when someone makes it personal.
When I look at the posters, the visual impact is so important, and I'm wondering if, although you say you haven't sort of seen a lot of these, I wonder what appeals about them is something that you kind of feel is slightly shared in some of the films you make. When you're making a film, how much do you worry about the visual aesthetic as opposed to the story itself? What comes first? What's your most sort of treasured part of filmmaking?
I don't think anything comes before the other. I think it coexists. It's like having two hands. Having one hand is fine, but having two is a lot more easier to deal with.
And do you think that violence in films, because obviously violence is a huge part of some of these exploitation titles, how do you use the capacity to shock in your films as a tool?
Well, I don't think about it. I mean, I'm not a political filmmaker in that sense. I just make films based on what I would like to see. But I think that there's a real difference between what we see in fiction and what we see in reality. And that will always be like that.
If I could come back to you, Alan, I was just looking through this and there's such a huge sort of scope of subjects. I mean, we've got everything from the angry red planet to terror creatures from the grave to aquasex. Do you have any which you just watch for almost pure comedy value?
I mean, I actually saw many of these movies in 42nd Street. Nicholas is still so jealous of me actually not being old enough to sort of like do that. I never looked down on these. I mean, I think they were an important part of me growing up. I mean, I was in New York in the 70s a hell of a lot, and I actually went to these cinemas, you know, like The Doll, The Deuce, you know, The Avco. There were so many of them. And, you know, that was part of the excitement. What we're trying to put across with the book is, although you're seeing the poster, you know, it was actually the excitement of getting in. You saw the poster and you thought, oh my God, this looks so great. You know, I daren't go into the cinema, you know, and will they let me in? And do I look 18 with an X rating? And, you know, and here's my money. And oh my God, there's a prostitute down the front of the cinema, and somebody's trying to lure me into the toilets. And it was just so exciting and all part of it. So you've got to sort of key that in to what actually that the film going experience was like also when you actually look at the posters too. I think it's important.
Nicholas, making this book, has it made you maybe more aware of your own film posters? Is that always something that you really take a really integral part of keeping a hand in when you're making films? Has it made you want to maybe make them more unusual or more scandalous or more sort of scintillating? Is film poster making still the art that it was?
I've always enjoyed, you know, how to promote the films I make. It's part of the job, you know. It's a very important job. And in terms of aesthetically, I think that there's a wonderful backlash against a very mundane promotion that a lot of these films suffer from, of just being bland, meaning that a lot of times it's about just information. You know, it's not the magic, it's just informing. And there's a huge, you know, movement of people suddenly taking movie posters to another level by doing their own or redesigning or and so forth. And what's interesting is that art is a way for us to have an identity, but we also use art to almost visualize who we are. And cinema posters, because cinema is such an openly machinery that's so huge in the market, that posters representing films is a very way to make a statement about who you are.
And Alan, which filmmakers coming up at the moment do you feel have the capacity to sort of cross from a purely perhaps shock value on the periphery of filmmaking to crossing over into making a more sort of mainstream statement?
I'm going to give you the heads up on a new guy called Can Evrenol. He's a Turkish filmmaker. His first film is going to be showing at Toronto's Midnight Madness. It is called Baskin, and it's unlike anything you have ever seen before. And it is actually, I'm dying to see what the reviews are going to be like, because it really does take you to very interesting places, in the same way that somewhere like Pascal Laugier, who did Martyrs, which is about the last time I was honestly truly shocked by a film because I could not believe what I was watching. And of course, Only God Forgive, one must mention this film because it was just so wonderfully well done. And I mean, joking aside, I think Nick is one of the best, most transgressive filmmakers out there. It's one of the reasons I love working with him. I mean, really, and when you see something like Only God Forgives, which is my personal favorite of his movies, I think he actually does really stretch the boundaries. He's looking a bit blushy over there, but I mean, it's a case of, I know he doesn't like me talking about that stuff in front of him, but you know, he's an important filmmaker. But Can Evrenol is especially going to be one you're going to be hearing a lot more about in the next couple of years.
One of the things that struck me in the book is there's films from across the world as well. There's like Finnish films and ones from, you know, the UK and everywhere else. But it seems that the exploitation genre was a way to kind of maybe unite a lot of disparate film communities. Do you think that there is the capacity for a genre to be able to do that today? Or do you think that it's more something like technology that brings people together these days?
I think it's all technology. I mean, a lot of these movies were foreign films that were purchased by American distributors because of the sex. Because this was the 60s and early 70s, and they would just dub them into English and pass them off as American films.
I have to tell you that the Angry Red Planet and the Time Traveler posters in there are by Ibn Melchior, and he actually was Danish. In fact, there was one point where we were actually going to be putting a lot more Danish material in the book, and then we suddenly thought, it's a bit sort of underlining. But there are representations of Danish filmmakers in there, but by no means is Ibn Melchior, who the one I'm mentioning, in any way a like downgraded person, because he's actually a really good artist.
And what are your thoughts on Melchior?
Well, Ibn Melchior was a very interesting Danish writer-director. I believe he passed away, but he was... you know, he traveled to America during the war and stayed in Hollywood. And one of the interesting things about him is that he wrote a film called Planet of Vampires, which became the basis for Alien. So you can say that it was a Danish man who came up with Alien.
Are there any other examples in the book where you've seen a kind of quite groundbreaking premise for a film that has later been imitated like that by more successful filmmakers?
Well, to be honest with you, this was the time, there was a melting pot of like rape, revenge sagas. So we did have to sort of knock a few of those on the head because they really were like, you know, violated, you know, rape of terror. But that was where that sort of whole rape, revenge that really became quite trendy with like Death Wish, the Death Wish movies in the 70s, sort of like had its sort of very early sort of inception. So I think there's those sort of subjects that lend themselves anyway to the exploitation element. I mean, you know, the mid-60s was ripe for that. I joked on the stage last night at the PFI that it got to the point where I was writing so much about, like, you know, bored housewife, wanting to try something new, turning to lesbianism, husband finding out, having threesome, and they end up in a kinky bondage three-way. I mean, seriously, that literally must have been the plot of about 5,000 of these movies. And I mean, and yet probably they were probably the biggest sellers because that's exactly what people wanted to see. You know, they were gearing towards their audience. We had another joke too, where you say that did they get these films out? There was one instance where a filmmaker went into one of the cinemas, asked to see the manager, a woman called Shelley Wilson, very, very famous on the exploitation line. She saw the film, thought it was great. Literally within 24 hours, she'd created a poster in the back room, put it outside, and it was showing. So that's how fast it was. It's almost echoing what's going on now in a way. You know, you film something, you put it on your iPhone, you put it on YouTube. So it's actually that sort of like what goes around comes around.
That was Monocle's Tom Hall talking to Nicholas Winding Refn and Alan Jones a little earlier. We'll be learning where comedy meets geography just after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
All this week here on Monocle 24, there have been stories of migration at national borders and the disregard for some of them, all been dominating the headlines. Geography, that timeless refuge of the brown-blazered, furrow-browed teacher in all of us, is suddenly a very timely topic.
Mark Cooper-Jones is a comedian who's been ahead of the curve, though, making this subject that he loves a major part of his day job for the past few years. And he joins us now to tell us why it's something we should all go that extra mile to love just a little bit more. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi there, guys.
Now, we need to kind of check your CV first. So, genuinely a geography lover, or was this just a bolt-on for the comedic circle, as it were?
It feels like every part of my career is a bolt-on to another part of my career, frankly. If by the end of this discussion one of you is able to tell me what I do for a living, That would be fantastic.
Because you don't have a corduroy jacket.
I haven't brought it. Oh, no, you're not meant to tell everybody that. I thought I could get away with it on a radio appearance.
Is this a prop you actually use?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, good.
With patches?
With patches. You can't get away without patches. I did one gig once, actually, in Manchester, where I just simply forgot to bring my corduroy jacket with the elbow patches. And I came out, I immediately told them I was a geography teacher, and a woman instantly said, "No, where's your jacket?" And it was the one time I forgot it, and I was utterly devastated. And now you've called me on it the second time, so thank you, Andrew.
Now, tell me, we said in there that, you know, your comedy transcends, you know, rocks and stalagmites and stalactites. It's about more than geographical features. You're looking actually at the world as we see it.
Actually, no. I think the difficulty with doing the comedy geography thing has been exactly that. I kind of tend to play on stereotypes about geography teachers, hence the jacket and the elbow patches. And I think what I find I'm talking about on stage a lot of the time is very classic geography, like stereotypical, what we all understand as school geography. And something I've always found quite difficult is trying to work in the actual stories that are happening today, the really important issues, because geography is actually quite miserable. And unless you end up doing satire on those things, and I'm not a satirist, then unfortunately you don't end up talking about, you know, those actual geographical issues that are right up to the minute. So my act itself, my geography comedy act, tends to be taking the mick out of what we perceive as geography teachers, referencing colouring in and stereotypes like that, and knowing all the countries and capitals and getting the audience to quiz
Burkina
me on
Faso.
Them. Ouagadougou. No.
Yeah, that's right. Well done. Well,
Good.
Well,
that's my heart's good.
He's been like
there.
This, and he
I'll throw in a couple more.
But at the same time, I, you know, as a geographer, I do have a huge passion for the subject, and I read all around it, and I kind of attend lectures and stuff. But I find it very difficult to get what is ultimately sometimes such an upsetting subject about the world to actually just be humorous on stage. So let's see if we can do it now, guys.
Let's go for it.
Let's go.
Do you find that it is becoming, so the more that you're working on issues surrounding geography, you're finding that they are more relevant to what's happening in the news every day?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I think that's one of the reasons geography is just such an important subject, and I would absolutely plead with anyone who is ever considering to take it further in education to do that. Because, yeah, I mean, some of the main things you're seeing in the news day to day, whether it's a story about sort of the obvious geography like climate change or the migration issues at the moment. But there are so many issues that have been thrown up around just the fact that globalization has accelerated so quickly over the last 20, 30 years. So many issues associated with that that I think it's important that people have a grounding in it just for their day-to-day lives and in the workplace. Employers seriously rate geography now as a subject because so many companies work on some kind of a global level that just having a general cultural literacy about places is really valuable.
And do you think that's part of the problem that, you know, as you were saying before with your comedy, a lot of it is sort of mocking the stereotypes about geography?
Yes.
Is that we don't quite feel comfortable with understanding how important it is to our everyday lives?
Definitely. I think geography is a bit of a dirty word, to be honest. I think it just has all these kind of classic stereotypes attached to it. Yeah, 100%.
Well, the other thing about geography is it always feels a bit dead as a subject. It kind of...
oh, right.
It always feels a bit like, as you say, kind of colouring in maps and charts.
Yeah.
And
the death kind of, by worksheets.
Yeah, and kind of people doing stuff on their own. It doesn't feel a very kind of like team effort geography. It is in reality, but you know, you think about it in kind of a slightly kind of lonely kind of way.
So we're getting an insight into how
I've revealed how what I felt about a school. Anyway,
every time they said, "Oh, teamwork and pair up," your eyes just rolled.
Tell me a little bit about your shift though, through, because it's always fascinating how people go from thinking, okay, perhaps I'm kind of funny, to making it a profession. Have you done that through the likes of, you know, Edinburgh, through stand-up? What was your journey from thinking, oh, actually, people find me funny, and to making it into a proper job?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's the difficult step to take. The first time you think, I'm now going to go on stage, and actually then you have a contract with the audience that says, I think I'm funny because I'm standing up here and I'm going to try to make you laugh, rather than just casually being with friends. I think the way it happened for me was it started at school, where I started writing some very bad sketches with a friend of mine, but we performed them at school, and then we decided that we would make sure we went to the same university together in order to carry on. We started a sketch group there. And yeah, we started going to the Edinburgh Festival. Again, student review sketches. They were of quite a low quality. but somehow, I mean, I'm still working with this guy and another chap who joined us at university as a group. And so stand-up came second.
But is the skill then for having some longevity and getting going, having some writing skills wrapped around your act?
Yeah, definitely. I think you definitely need the writing skills. So we started by writing characters, and you know, that's very different to stand-up in a sketch world. And I think also very important was the fact that there was a group of us, because we were able to go into a very difficult world of comedy together. And we had each other to support each other and talk about it. Just starting as a stand-up, I would find absolutely terrifying. So I think working as a team, as us geographers do, Andrew, was really the key to kind of getting in there. And that helped me grow the confidence to start doing the stand-up after that.
Papua New Guinea.
Port Moresby.
Well done.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Yeah, yeah.
Now, here's a question then.
No, you should ask him if some in return, I think. He's meant to be like...
What's your specialism then, Steve?
Oh, no. I think we're not going to...
He's meant to be the foreign affairs editor. He was a foreign affairs editor. He should know them all.
In a room, I'm quite comfortable with sort of someone asking me, you know, to name the capital of a certain country or the nation which a capital is of. But in a room with a geography teacher, I feel that I might not be quite as good. So no, we're not going to turn this back on me. I have a question about teaching and comedy, because there is weirdly a link between the two, in that in both situations, you are standing up in front of a group of people that either want to be impressed or expecting to be impressed, or don't really want to be there. They're a
or
bit
who
bored.
Might throw things at you.
Or who might throw things at you. Exactly.
Yeah.
And you've got to impress them.
Yeah, 100%. I think...
So is one good training for the other?
I think they're both good training for both. It's important not to forget which one you're doing at any one point. But you can't stand up in front of the kids and accidentally let slip perhaps a bit of your act that is a swear word, or tried too hard to make them laugh because they see you coming. And also, crucially, it's important not to stand in front of an audience and genuinely start teaching them geography, which is something I've been at risk of doing on a few occasions.
You find that they don't work too well with that, particularly when you ask them to now work in pairs.
Actually, interestingly, some of the best bits of my stand-up have been when I've just taught stuff. Sometimes people will put their hand up and ask a question because they've got quite into the whole geography of it. And then I've usually have one of those old school overhead projectors on stage, you know, the ones that kind of, you know, without any kind of computing involved in them, just light up with the acetates, exactly. And sometimes I find myself sort of drawing how oxbow lakes are formed just because somebody's asked. But, I mean, nobody's laughing, but I do think everyone's enjoying themselves. I think so, anyway. Yeah, and the heckling, as one of you said, is definitely something you really kind of learn from a skill from both things. I think, you know, just being able to come up with something on the spot and improvise, the teaching has helped with that, I'd say. Definitely.
And is it, I know you've said the whole, it's a performance, it's a sketch, it's more than a joke, but is there a geography joke you can tell us?
Well, look at this. Oh, now I'm being put on the spot
Yeah. Well, that is your job.
I mean, I would say it's very character-led, the whole thing, really. I have a joke.
Okay, give us a joke.
So geography comes from, the word geography comes from the Greek words geo, meaning earth, and graphy, meaning writing, which is why, for me, geography is the best subject on earth.
Oh.
That's not the noise you're supposed to... Actually, to be fair, that is exactly the noise that gets made whenever I deliver that on stage.
Do you want to get the overhead projector
out? Not being funny, but, does your act have a kind of audience? Because, you know, in a way, you know, lots of people probably hated the school and don't want to think about it again. But do you find it's, you know, academics, university people, you know, when you're playing university towns, that you kind of get more laughs than perhaps in a kind of a regular kind of comedy act plays?
It's quite a broad audience, actually. Surprisingly broad. I think because everybody had a geography teacher, there's an access point for almost everybody, weirdly. It seems to appeal for sort of older people as well. I think it's maybe because the memory is further away and they want to get back in touch with it. But I'd say there's a certain type of audience that doesn't enjoy it, and that is the sort of audience which have come to a comedy night for a kind of a rowdy affair. Right. And if I start talking about geography and naming all the states of America, which I'm now not going to do, and, you know, just having a bit of fun around this kind of bumbling geography teacher character and what they want essentially are penis jokes, then they're not going to get that. So there's a type of audience that sometimes expects a certain type of thing, like a stag do audience. And that's not really my kind of audience. But I mean, I've had lots of different types and you've really enjoyed it. So, yeah.
And Mark, people who want to see your act or want to know more about you, what's the kind of key things to know? Where could they see you soon?
Yeah, well, I'm doing an hour of a show called Mark Cooper Jones, Geography Teacher. Really was a stretch to come up with that one. I'm doing that at the Elgar Rooms, which is at the Royal Albert Hall on the 22nd of September. So that's the next full hour. And if you don't know where the Royal Albert Hall is, it's very near the Royal Geographical Society.
Okay. And you will supply teaching soon at?
hopefully nowhere.
Wonderful. Well, first of all, before I say thank you and goodbye, South Sudan?
Juba.
Yeah, okay.
Fine. Oh, okay. He's good.
It's new. It's new.
You have to learn the newer
Steve's
ones.
Steve's really irritated because you're better than he is.
Well, no, look, okay.
No, don't.
Can you do autonomous countries? Countries that aren't really countries yet?
So far, my list extends to the UN-recognised countries and capitals.
Okay, so if I said Somaliland?
I wouldn't be able to give it to you, I'm afraid. Have you got it?
That's only because he's been there for a story.
Do you know it?
Yeah.
What is it?
Hargeisa.
Oh, well, very well. Oh, because he's been there for a story. All right.
It's
like,
it's rubbish. Excellent. I'm glad we ended on the knowledge that I have.
I can't believe this. I feel like I've been done.
Mark Cooper Jones, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that's all for this edition 322 of the Monocle Weekly. And a good show, Steve.
I felt so, yes.
Geography teacher. You're quite mean, actually.
No, you're
determined to kind of like pull his act apart and prove that he didn't know what he was on about.
I didn't want to try and prove he didn't know what he was. I mean, he did know what he was on about. He named all of them, apart from Somaliland, which isn't technically a country, so that's fine.
Okay, I think he did very, very well. A very nice show, and also really fascinating to hear about Gore Vidal. I like a guest who's got a kind of a good anecdote up their sleeve from the launch.
I know. I like that. He didn't even really breathe and let us ask many questions. We didn't really need to. I like the knocking as well, though.
No. He knew how to kind of get the whole story out.
And I really like the hearing the Norman Mailer story, because I'd heard that before. I'd seen it written down.
It's one of those things that you always wonder whether it's kind of apocryphal, but indeed it wasn't.
There we are.
Well, thank you, Jay, for telling us all those great stories. But that is it for this week. Let's thank all the team behind the show. I'll thank Tom Hall, you did a fine job producing this show, and Bill Luty, who researched it. Oh, my voice went a bit high there. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly is going to be back the same time again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.